Good afternoon. I know I'm the only thing standing between you and the ice cream, so we'll see what we can do about that. So that's the title of the talk. What I wanted to do was give you a thesis to start the talk off, and then I'll work towards that thesis. Here's my thesis, that we're all going to look an awful lot more like Google, insert your favorite .com, over the next 10 years, and software development has changed forever. Now it's our turn. So let's start by looking at a short history of software development. The age of the dinosaurs, when it all began. So the place that software development started was the waterfall model. The original paper was by a guy called Winston Royce in 1970, and it's important when I talk about waterfall to point out that his original paper never suggested it was a unidirectional flow. In fact, it said that would fail. It said it had to have the feedback loops and all of the things that we then didn't do. So the underlying theory behind the waterfall model was this notion of left to right progression through from requirements to architecture to design to code to test to release. Those basic chunks. You can find slightly different names for them, different methodologies that are based on this. This is the mechanism, or should I say the methodology, that all other methodologies have been based on since the dawn of software engineering. But again, the key attributes here are left to right progress, but also right to left traceability. So if I find a piece of code, the theory goes that piece of code will trace back through design, through architecture, to requirements that drive it. That was one of the underlying theories of that. Now, of course, we all know the method is broken. The first problem was it was all based on a big bad guess. We know what we want out of a system that we're not going to get for 2 years. We're going to put together a 2,000-page tomb of requirements with the business sitting down with business analysts and those sorts of people, and the result would be something that was exactly what we wanted. And, of course, it was always based on the fact that we knew what that was going to be and we were wrong. The second big lie was that, well, of course, even if we did actually deliver everything we said that we were going to and it was what you actually asked for, well, the world will have moved on in those 2 years anyway, so it will no longer be the right thing. And this is part of the overarching problem we have with monolithic software development. The third huge lie was that the fact is that all developers are not equal. Survey after survey, and there was the book called The Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering, which quotes some of these. There is a 20-to-1 difference in productivity between the best programmers and the worst programmers. 20-to-1. Now, if I was hiring programmers, I'd pay an extra 10-20% for the good ones and build a team out of them. But as we'll see, that's not the way that corporations like to do things. They like to pay everyone the same. And so they don't like the idea that developers are not all equal. The other big, huge lie was this notion of the A team versus the B team. That this A team, the really good people, would architect and build this system, and once they had, they'd lob it over the fence, and a completely different team would have to maintain it. Now, of course, the problem with that is they never got to see all of their mistakes. They never had to maintain and actually tune and make their product work. They were always moving on to the next shiny thing, which meant that it was actually the B team that were the better programmers that had to make things work and make them work over the life of the software, which is hopefully about 90% of its life. So where do those mistakes come from? I posit that there are these root causes behind it all. The first is HR. Like I said, HR does not like that you can't just use programmers as interchangeable cogs. It wants fungibility. It wants people that can be swapped in and out as necessary, come up to speed straight away, no learning time, no nothing. And that leads on to the second point. It was also based on an entirely the wrong model. It was based on this construction-type model where you have the architects who do all of the designs and all of this work, and then the rest is just construction. It was based on the idea that all of the creativity was front-loaded in that architectural document, and maybe a little bit in the design, and that the coding was a totally uncreative process. How many people found that to be true? So It was based on another falsehood. And then the third one is that if you're going to spend $20 million in 2 years, you want some sort of guarantee that you're going to get an outcome, which means that there's an awful lot of project management of formality around trying to guarantee that the result you get is worthwhile at the end of it. Now, of course, all this was irrelevant because there were failure rates somewhere between 50 and 90%, depending on how you count them. So huge, huge failure rates despite all of these efforts. So that's the waterfall methodology. Of course, this is what has existed since the 70s, since the 60s, actually. And while that was going on, the environment was changing. We were changing the environment in which we developed software, especially as we moved into the times of the 80s and the 90s with Unix and mini computers and microcomputers and department servers. This all changed. Small interconnected systems started to appear. We were no longer building code just run on one monolithic machine. We went to client server with remote procedure calls. In those days, it was with thick clients talking to thick servers. We started with introducing middleware and the service bus. We introduced design patterns in 94, and I think this was a really important thing for software engineering, because for the majority of software, for business software, really you're just pushing bits around, and there really are only 20 or 30 ways to do that. So the notion of software design patterns really helps with the maintainability of the code, because previous to that, everyone was just putting code together to solve the problem their way, and you ended up with each piece of software being extremely unique and therefore extremely difficult to maintain by someone other than the original author, and even by the original author after a little while had passed and they forgot what they did and why they did it. So that was happening. And of course, the web was starting to appear at this time too. We were creating these huge distribution chains, which where we'd have to get it through QA into a manufacturing line. First customer ship is frozen. It goes down to get printed onto CDs to be pushed out to the reseller channels, so that you could walk into a shop and buy a CD. Those days were starting to come to an end. None of this happens overnight, of course. There's a lot of overlap, but they were the trends as they were appearing. And of course, then we finally moved with the web into a three-tier architecture, model view controller, which was actually one of the design patterns from the patterns book. And in fact, that model view controller view of the world is the basis for Ruby on Rails. That's the success of Ruby on Rails has really been derived from its implementation of MVC. So all of this is going on, and this is really, we're in the 90s. And around about that time, a lot of people were getting really annoyed and frustrated by the waterfall model, by all of its failings. And so a group got together, and the first of the countervailing methodologies that came about was extreme programming, XP, which unfortunately was around the same time as Windows XP, causing a little bit of confusion. But extreme programming introduced a balanced set of engineering and management disciplines to allow for just enough process, to allow you to write real code. Now, the overarching characteristic of all of those waterfall methodologies was effectively trying to put programmers at the edge of the software development experience. What extreme programming did was take the pendulum and swing it hard up the other way and put the programmers right back smack bang in the middle of the software development effort, which was a wonderful thing. It was about going from this notion that programmers are interchangeable units that we don't really trust to we trust our programs, we're going to support them in doing the right thing. So and I guess one of the other things, in the 90s, there are four variables we talk about in any project. We talk about time, we talk about quality, we talk about scope. Time, quality, scope, what's the other one? Quality, oh, no, I said that. Time, quality, scope. Cost, that's the other one, thank you. And what we found in the 90s with the microcomputers and web-based development was there was this desperate need to get into the market first. That was perceived as the overriding concern. And so what happened as we pushed to the market first was the advent of a thing known as good enough software, where the dial we tweaked was the quality dial. And so the idea was, you know, the classic Microsoft release of get it out the door and let the next six releases get the bugs out. Getting the market first was the most important thing. So part of that was what probably the final nail in the coffin that made XP explode within certain places, because programmers don't want to do poor quality. Programmers inherently want to do good work. And XP allowed them to control quality. In fact, with XP, it takes three of those variables off the table, and the only one you're dealing with is scope. So XP begat, as I said, XP was one of these methodologies. There was a bunch of them happening in the late 90s. They all coalesced, and all of the authors of all of these methodologies came together in 2001 to create the Agile Manifesto, which was basically saying, we want to write good code, let us write good code. We value individuals and interactions over processes and tools. We value working software over comprehensive documentation. We value customer collaboration over contract negotiation. And we value responding to change over following a plan. So this was very much about completely inverting what the traditional SDLC. Now, there's a bunch of stuff you can't read unless you're in the front row, but that was the stuff that sat behind those. And it's all to do with having conversations with the business. Deliver software frequently from a couple of weeks to a couple of months. So let's talk about that. So Agile is about doing everything in time-boxed iterations. What you do is you take all of the parts of the project that you want to deliver and you put them on the project backlog. You work in two-week iterations. You deliver software every 2 weeks. That's the normal. Now, of course, it's tuned. It could be as high as 6 weeks, but the idea is shorter the better. And because you want to make sure that this is a compressed world where testing is inherent in what we do rather than something that's done at the end of the cycle, because that was part of the breakage of the old world. And so the shorter the cycle, the more you have to take on the notion, the completeness of Agile rather than just doing tiny bits of it that you think you like. So you take the iteration backlog, and the point about the iteration backlog is it is a prioritized set of stories, not prioritized by engineering, prioritized by the business. So if I'm working the top story, I'm always working the thing that is most important to the business. And that means that, you know, and of course, at this point, the stories are all small enough to fit in an iteration. So the story is the name that we use for that unit of work. We then slot a bunch of stories into an iteration. We work that iteration. And at the end of each iteration, you will have code that can be released. You don't have to release it. You won't release every iteration, theoretically, but you can. Which means at any time the business can say, I need to get these features out to the market, you can run it through the system fast. You can actually go from idea to released in a matter of days. So the idea is you'd have a couple of iterations and you would typically have a release every 2, 3, 4 iterations. Each iteration looks the same. You have a planning session where you work out what you're going to fit in. You then do the work. At the end of it, you have a showcase to show the business the value you've delivered. And then you have a retrospective where you ask, what do we do well and what do we not do well? In fact, you ask it in three questions to say, what should we start doing, what should we stop doing, and what should we keep doing? And so there's this notion of a cadence, a rhythm that comes in. And because you're releasing software every 2 weeks, there's no longer those 50-hour days and these cramming at the end of as you head into a release to get stuff finished and dealing with all of the integration nightmare because you left that to the end and dealing with all the testing because you left that to the end. So what happens with Agile is it becomes a nice smooth rhythm. And it's about this. In the old world, all the functionality was delivered at the end, which means you're running a very high-risk delivery because until the very end, you haven't got anything. You might halt the project 80% of the way through and get nothing for it. With Agile, you get these drops of functionality all the way through. The risk is gone. So that's Agile. So that's software development and how it's evolved over the last 30, 40 years. Let's talk about dev versus ops, part one. We all have a rather delicate experience, a delicate history, relationship with development. The first wrong assumption they often make is that production looks just like development. Why wouldn't it look just like this box on my desk? How many people have found that sort of software problem? Okay. The second one, well, if it doesn't look just like development, surely it looks just like a vendor install. How many? And the third. Well, okay, I accept that it doesn't look like development, and I accept that it doesn't look like a vanilla install, but surely it's static. So the interesting question then that we have to ask is if we've had this rivalry, this tension between ourselves and development, how did it get this way? They've got these extremely formal methodologies. How did we get here? So we got here because if you look at these documents that define that waterfall SDLC, they don't even mention operations. They don't mention it all. They all assume that the programmers will deal with operational aspects of the system the same way they will deal with any other requirements. In other words, if we haven't put our needs into their requirements, they won't be dealt with. And that's where the problem comes from. They all assume one bad thing. So the interesting thing here is that Rational, in 2003, they still did not get operations. They still did not get how to capture and deal with these non-functional requirements, as they like to call them. So the great assumption, of course, therefore, is that we're all in the room, that we are feeding our requirements to those development teams. And that's a very interesting point of contention, because that same thing can derail agile projects. Because agile projects can just be talking to the business and getting features and not be talking to operations and not getting those stories to put into iterations to create maintainable, scalable software. So all of the same things that cause problems for us in the old world can produce the same problems for us in the new world. DevOps, by its very nature, puts an ops person in the room. That's the first step in fixing that. That's the most important step in fixing that. It, of course, doesn't guarantee the right stories are on the board, but it means someone who should be able to ask the right questions and put those stories on the board is there. So what are the right stories to put on the board? And I guess an anecdote. When I was at eSmith back in 2001, what we did was we created a product council, and we had the head of support and the head of ops and the head of engineering and the product line manager all sitting in a room deciding exactly what features, what bugs to put into the next release. So we addressed that particular issue head on. And you can produce an imbalance from release to release. You can say, we need to get these features out. We're not going to deal with those bugs or engineering stories this release. If you do that too many times in a row, you end up with technical debt and everything slows down because you have to deal with a system that is not as clean, not as maintainable. So, what are the things that we need to put on the wall if we want to deliver better software, if we want the engineering team to deliver better software? It's what I call serviceability criteria. So, how do we make our life less stressful? Each production environment is, of course, unique. I used to say that if I give three different organizations the same five boxes, the same five software, they will look completely different by the end of the install, and then they'll continue to diverge. That's the nature of our job. We take these pieces and we create a solution that works for our customers, our managers, our organization. So clearly we need the ability to adapt whatever is written to these highly divergent environments. The environment is always changing. We're adding disk, we're adding users, we're adding this, we're changing that. Different compliance regulations for how long we have to keep log files and tables. And so we need to have all of those controls exposed so we can maintain them. It's all about exposing controls, and it's all about exposing controls in a consistent way. So the operational requirements, which are often referred to as non-functional requirements, which I really don't like as a word, because the idea is you have functional requirements and non-functional requirements. Now, if I'm the business and I have to choose between functional requirements and non-functional requirements, guess what? So the interesting thing for us as the professionals of system administration, the serviceability criteria are global. Wouldn't it be great if all of our applications from all of our vendors, including internal and external commercial off the shelf, all exposed to controls the same way? Would that make our lives a little bit easier? Wouldn't it be great if a professional association that was representing system administrators could work on creating that universal set? The extended operating environment is what we would do within a company, so all of our applications have to use the same file naming standards and mount points and all that sort of stuff. And then you actually have the truly application-specific things, which typically are transaction volumes, things like that. So the problem is that as an industry, we have left every individual system in to fight for themselves and repeat the same mistakes. We need to do better. One last thing on programming. All programming projects to succeed have to deal with what I refer to as the grammar of programming, which is change control, version control, build and release control. If you don't have those things right, your project's going to have trouble. Okay, so that's the end of the history of software development. Now let's look at system administration. I have to apologise. This is going to be a highly expurgated version of the history of system administration, and I'm going to, unfortunately, ignore a lot of very good work by a lot of very good people, so I apologise in advance. It is not intentional. So the problem we have is that the whole place the industry started was I bought some machines, and they were really, really expensive machines back then. I need to throw some people at them to keep them running. So our existence was created as an entirely reactive support group, and we've really been fighting that ever since. Hardware was expensive, people were cheap. Started off with a bunch of large systems, you know, everyone was doing their own thing, there were no standards, we had every type of networking you could think of, some decknet, some netware, token ring, we had bespoke configurations, we had big iron, scalable, highly scalable, vertically only. You had to keep growing the hardware to grow the capacity. And everyone had a Unix variant. In fact, if something ended in the word IX, it was someone else's Linux variant. I kept suggesting we might have Yomix or one of those, but I never quite got around to writing it. And really, we were all sort of looking at, with the time that Linux and Minix and these were coming out, we were all looking at writing our own Linuxes as well, just because why wouldn't you? It just turns out that one of us did a good job of it. And as a system administration, you know, the community was really starting to come together. In the 90s, the 80s and 90s were really interesting. But one of the things that was most interesting was we knew what we were doing and no one else did. If you asked someone, you tell someone you're a system administrator, they were like, what? If you wanted to hire a system administrator, you couldn't. You had to hire some other position because HR didn't know what a system administrator was. You hired a programmer or a research scientist or an administrator because that was how you got them into the HR system. And the problem then is we actually, if we're hired as a programmer, we're really doing a lousy job because we're not writing much code. If we're hired a research scientist, we're doing a lousy job because we're not doing research papers. So you end up with this conflict that was happening. In fact, there's a story from the first Sage get together when Sage was formed back in 92, I think it was, where everyone went to dinner and they went around the room and at that table of all of these industry leading system administrators, there was an archaeologist, there was a mathematician, there was a physicist, there was a couple of that were, I can't remember what they were now, but these were roles that had nothing to do with computing, they just sort of found their way into them. And that was the nature of, and to some extent still is the nature of the beast. Some of us have spoken about trying to teach system administration and doing it by having someone from the medical faculty teach diagnostic skills. I'm not sure we want them to teach the user management skills or you know, bedside manner. Using a psychologist maybe to teach the bedside manner and the counselling skills that we have to use. Using the computer science people to teach those bits. So very much it's a hybrid profession. LISA conference was going from 86, and if I've got my numbers right, it was 100 users or 1 gig of storage was our definition of large. Okay, I might have been out by ear. Sage started in 92, Sage U started in 93. And before that, we had the Sun User Group, which was the de facto version of those, but was obviously vendor-specific. And as I said, we were called all sorts of things. The profession continues to develop, though, because what's happened with the formation of a group like Sage is all of these minds are coming together and trying to talk about what it is we do, how we do it. So we end up with things like the SACMM, which was an attempt to adapt the capability maturity model to systems administration. That was from Lisa in 93. We had the Sage Jobs Description booklet come out in 93. We had a bunch of work to do with unit courses in systems administration and more. So CQU, Central Queensland University, and of course University of Oslo, we started seeing these courses pop up where we're actually trying to teach, to bring some educational formality to system administration. Things continue to develop. Sun comes out with the phrase, the network is the computer. Of course, it was not in the time of the internet. That was mostly pre-internet. But TCP has already become the standard network at that point. We've already solved part of our wall. Custom IT solutions, everyone is special, every solution unique, that continues. In fact, that arguably continues most of the way to today. Tools start to appear. Sudo and Top come back away. So Bill LaFay, thank you for Top. Wherever he is. RDIS comes out, Perl starts to appear in 93. CF Engine goes all the way back to 93, so I think Mike's teaching today, he doesn't get to hear his plug. MRTG in 95, so you can see that around the mid-90s, we're starting to actually develop tools that help us in our jobs. There's a lot of work around the formality or the formalization of what we do. The one that's, I quote because I wrote it, the system administrator's body of knowledge. Before ITIL, so this actually goes back further than 95, but there was a talk I gave in Seattle in 99, and the white papers go back to about 95. It was an attempt to say, what are our areas of responsibility? So we were looking at this from a perspective of, what do I do in my role if I take a couple of steps back? And these were the areas that I came up with, change management, problem management. They look familiar, don't they? But the interesting thing here is that if you look at the white paper version of this, if you look at change management, there is a set of specific questions you want to ask. The whole idea is, what constitutes good practice? One of the problems we have with ITIL is that it allows you to get line up with the runway, but it won't help you land the plane. It won't help you apply it to your particular business. And by design, it is organizational oriented, it is process oriented, it is not about technical practices. So you have to take that ITIL framework and you have to adapt it to your organization. As I said, that's by design and there's nothing wrong with that. But then the question becomes, okay, so what guidance do we have in how to land the plane? And that's where more specific technical practices, such as the things we do, come into play. The other thing that's interesting here is that whilst we're going through this war about what a system administrator is, the people who didn't want to think that they're system administrators, like the Cisco guys, or in fact there was a little interesting adventure with Microsoft. Microsoft wanted to call theirs network administrators, and they then brought out a certification where the system administrator was a lower certification because they wanted to make it out that it was easier than theirs and less important than theirs. The problem is that if you look at what Windows administrators do, you look at what network engineers do, it's the same stuff. They're all still doing capacity planning. They're all still doing change management. They're all still doing these things. They're all system administrators. One of the ongoing problems we've got as a profession is how we deal with these groups that don't self-identify as system administrators. So this then leads on to the rise of the web. We now finally get to a point where we have thin clients, we have a consistency around that, we have web app DB, but at this point, while the web's rising during the 2000 era, it's still physical servers. And so it's usually Linux at the edge, Solaris at the core. That, of course, gives way to the commoditization, Penguin rising. So Linux and Windows on Intel. Linux has won the startups. Sun, IBM are still battling for the enterprise, but that battle's heading towards close. And virtualization's just starting to pick up now at the end of the first dot-com rush. Finally, we get to the emergence of the cloud. Nothing will ever be the same again. The wars are over. It's Linux, it's x86, it's VMs. It's Amazon Web Services brings us infrastructure on demand. That's the first time we've had that. That, of course, begats the second wave, which is the rise of the API. We now have companies that specialize in APIs. Infrastructure as code, of course, is one of the upshots of doing this. Automation is driven by scale, so the WebOps movement, which is the beginning of DevOps, is all about the need for highly scalable solutions to deliver web-based services to a large number of customers. So this is all, you know, starts to follow in, and then we end up with a new set of names, SRE, WebOps, and DevOps, all, of course, none of whom self-identify as system administrators. So that's the brief version of what happens there. So let's talk about DevOps. The same way that the failure of the waterfall drove developers to change the way they develop software, cloud-based sites and the need to rapidly provision, rapidly scale infrastructure is driving how we manage our infrastructure. So we are where we are because there's a vacuum that needs to be filled. And DevOps is the current way that that's looking to be filled. DevOps is to system administration what Agile is to software development. It is first and foremost about culture and attitude. So DevOps is about creating that collaborative environment, about dev and ops together, hence the name. It's of course about practices and processes, and it's about technology and tools. The culture, of course, is all about sitting at the same side of the table. So one of the things that you learn about when you study, there used to be this fad of studying body language. And one of the things that's interesting is when you go into a meeting, if you sit on opposite sides of the table, you are effectively battling each other. You've gone into a contentious discussion. If you sit on the same side of the table, you're working the problem together. And it's actually amazingly interesting how much you can change the dynamic of a meeting based on where you sit. Same thing here. Getting dev and ops in the room together is all about sitting on the same side of the table. And of course, that means visibility of each other's workflow, shared food and discussions, crossover, all that sort of stuff. The most common practices are the developer behavior changes. So they, of course, are now starting to build infrastructure as code. They are starting to do continuous integration, which is about having a clean code base ready to ship. And they are actually starting to do production support. They're carrying pages. They're actually having to feel the hurt for their bad decisions. And, you know, that really helps them clean up the coding act fast. And behaviors also change. So we're now embedded with the dev teams. We're working with them on a day-to-day basis. So literally, you have an ops member of the dev team helping guide all of the developers' work. And Kanban walls for ops. And for those who don't know a Kanban wall, it looks a bit like this. The thing with, we're used to all of these. We've got trouble ticketing systems. This is really just in some sense, it's a little extension on the trouble ticketing systems we've used, but in another sense, it's quite drastic in what it can do. Now, I'm a big believer in electronic Kanban walls, not post-it notes that fall off walls, but the idea is that you've got the same sort of states of, you know, ready, active review done that you would have in a ticketing system. And the difference is that you are always working the tickets in priority order. You can only take one or two cards at a time, so it becomes clear if you've started taking too many things and you're therefore getting bogged down. It's about the trick here is that you turn the model from a push model to a pull model, which is one of the underlying values in the Kanban system, is that when I am free, I will take the next available ticket, which is the highest priority ticket, and I will work it. It's not a matter of I'm assigning these tickets to people and I'm controlling them from a central point. And that's one of the key underlying principles of Kanban. I won't go into that in any more detail because that's a tutorial for another day. But you should all be looking at Kanban walls because what we do is you put the Kanban walls up, you have a 15-minute stand-up meeting every day, and the stand-up meeting is always the same format. What did I do yesterday? What am I going to do today? And what are the blockers? And it's a stand-up meeting because everyone wants to get uncomfortable if they're there too long. If someone wants to get into a discussion, you put it on the park list and you come back to it after the meeting. So anyone who's interested can have those discussions. You're not trying to shut discussion down. You're trying to focus the stand-up part of the meeting on the stand-up. And you will find then that your communications problem has gone up drastically. that now your communications efficiency has gone up drastically. You've got all the people knowing what everyone else is working on a daily basis. Much better than scrambling around trouble ticket systems that you don't know have been assigned to people to work out what they're working on. Big step forward. And of course, this is the equivalent of the Kanban walls that you have in agile software. So DevOps tools, there's a lot of them. There's the configuration management ones like Puppet Chef, Babushka CF Engine. There's a lot of change management, but GitHub seems to be the most popular of those. I'm not going to go into any of these in particular detail. Jenkins Capistrano for build management, for continuous integration. Rails, of course, has an inherent test framework. You also have Cucumber or Vagrant for spinning up VMs. So there's a bunch of different tools that are out there that are being used to do the DevOps type work. And frameworks. You've got Amazon Web Services, of course. You've got VMware Dynamic Ops. With Vagrant, you can spin up VMs on your own machine. BMC CLM are commercial. These are commercial frameworks. You've then got all the open source ones of OpenStack, CloudForms, Eucalyptus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're currently in the land grab. There is going to be 20 times this number of frameworks in the next few years. And then at the end of that period, we're going to coalesce back to some standards. There will still be then 20 products, but they will all be stuck behind the same standards that emerge, and that will be good for the consumer. But at the moment, this is very much in the we don't know exactly what the road forward looks like mode. Cucumber is interesting as a way to write validation tests in an English language. So this is, again, taken from the agile side of things, but adopting it to DevOps tools, so to system tests. The example there is a very simple one, but you can see the inherent power in that system. With use cases, we often like to say things in terms of I want, so that, and that sort of format, and so it reflects that sort of format. Back in 2004, Trey Harris gave a invited talk at LISA about Commands Guarded, which was a Perl module to do idempotent scripting. There is another one now that's based on Ruby, and so for the Ruby programmers, a very easy learn, which is Babushka, so you can basically say met meet, and the idea is that I can run, it's idempotent, so I run the same script as many times as I like, and it will only ever execute if it needs to. So it checks the met criteria. If the met criteria is there, it doesn't need to execute anything. If it's not there, it executes the meet section, and then it reruns the met question to see, am I now meeting it? If I didn't, I throw an error. If I did, we're done. So basically, very important when we're scripting is idempotency. So what does DevOps do? So as I said, ops are now in the room. That's one of the single biggest improvements in how we work together. They do after-hour support. They, of course, by doing all of this, they're building more maintainable code, both because we're telling them how and because they're feeling the pain when they don't. They, of course, get a much better, a much more complete end-to-end system view now. So they can see and respond to problems in their code across the entire lifecycle, which is a really huge change. Configuration management's automated, change management's automated, and continuous integration and release. Let's talk about that last one. So to do continuous integration and release is the same thing as doing test-driven development. So one of the big changes that came out of XP and in Agile is this notion of write your tests first. Test-driven development means I will write my tests first, and then I will write the code, because then I'm writing the code, not writing the tests tainted by the code and just testing the code. I'm actually writing the tests to meet the criteria. And one of the subtleties of that is if I'm writing code that can be tested more easily, then I'm writing code that is more maintainable implicitly. Same thing applies here. If I'm doing continuous integration, I am keeping my code base cleaner. I am getting it to a point where it requires me to be well-behaved and keep the code base clean. And continuous release is the next part of that, is if you're doing continuous integration, then you can effectively should be able to release at any point. And that's one of the things, that if we're working an agile iteration and we've got 75% of the stories done and the iteration's closing, well, we can ship that because it's code clean, it's continuous integration, it can ship now. So this is interesting because I found a slide from 2000, and you can tell from the wonderful colours that I chose. It really is from 2000. Here I'm saying that most software practices assume that they have the target environment to themselves. They make big assumptions about its configuration, and even if that were so... So the interesting thing is that DevOps actually inverts this, because with infrastructure being effectively free as it is now, they really do have the target environment for themselves. So 12 years later, that is an interesting place to be, where we're actually farming out more machines, creating more machines to give ourselves that isolation and that control that we didn't have in such a multi-tenant environment that we had on Big Iron. So DevOps is a lot of things. It's also not a lot of things. And the real answer is it's not fully cooked, because it's the beginning of a journey. Agile, yeah, it's first appeared in XP in the late 90s, and it's now moving into the enterprise 10 years later. DevOps is on a much faster velocity. So it's not a silver bullet. Obviously, things still break. We still have to do all of our normal system administration work of troubleshooting and firefighting and arguing between the vendors as to whose fault it is. It's not complete. It's only looking at a particular part of the problem space. It's therefore, there's no sense of, oh, well, this will be a replacement for ITIL, or this will be a replacement for SABOC. There are all of those other things you have to do as system administrators, in addition to the stuff that DevOps does. It is at this point not highly scalable into traditional enterprise environments. How many people here think that DevOps is a great way to run your core systems that have been running for 10 years? Right. There were some interesting discussions in the session before this, which was about disruptive technologies. And one of the first speakers spoke about how cloud and API is going to change the world, and the second speaker said, actually, they're not, because we're still running the crap we had from 10 years ago. And they're both right. They're both right. So DevOps is very much going to change the world, but it's not going to do it overnight. We still have all of these issues that we have to deal with our legacy systems. It doesn't solve the issue of what are the right serviceability criteria to ask for. It doesn't solve the problem of technical debt, or what I like to call shoemaker projects, the old story of the shoemaker goes without shoes. So actually doing projects to make our life better, and therefore our customers. Service monitoring, it critically relies on service monitoring, but that doesn't mean it solves the problem. There's no magic solutions here. We've still got a lot of work to do in that space. And the rest of the ops cycle, and of course, professional ethics. You've still got to learn how to be and continue to be a professional. This is not stuff you learn from DevOps. As I said, you know, making DevOps work or WebOps type systems work in the enterprise, excuse me, you can't just throw our infrastructure. We've got a lot of legacy there. I am working with a customer with 25,000 machines, including some very interesting old things like Windows NT 3.5. You can't turn off some systems, unfortunately, not easily. Vertically scaled apps. One of the things that underpins DevOps and WebOps is this notion that you can do this horizontal scaling, that you spin up more infrastructure and that you have load balances that are all built into the infrastructure. Unfortunately, a lot of apps don't work that way. A lot of apps require vertical scaling. And until the software development world catches up and allows us to move to horizontally scaled solutions, then we're still going to have these issues to deal with. Enterprise change management is a very different beast to what DevOps does. And I'll come back to that. Poorly behaving vendors. Let's talk about that one. That's always fun. How many people have dealt with really badly written vendor software? Yeah. We've been speaking about this for a long time. In 94, Craig Bishop gave his paper at the first or second SAJU conference, first one, I think, called No, You Can't Have Root. Because all of these installation scripts, 70K installation scripts that expect to run as root. They might need it for three lines, but they want the whole script to run as root. How many people have seen those? Right. So we've been speaking about these sorts of problems for a long time. I've given a tutorial on it. I wrote a paper on it in 95, which you can find on my website. I then gave a tutorial based on it in 2001. Lee Damon and myself spoke about this at a tutorial at LISA in 2005. You know, these problems haven't gone away. And here are slides from 2000. Let's see how many of these are still applicable. So this is the trick, is whenever their software is poorly behaved, what we are having to do is second-guess the developers, both as to their intent and their behaviour. So this is a really interesting thing, that You've got all these people on the one hand who it's argued are socially challenged, but on the other hand, they get in the minds of all these other people who work out what they did wrong. It's an interesting dynamic. Here are some examples. Literally, a 70 kilobyte shell script that ran as root. People dumping DLLs into the Microsoft, into the Win32 system directory sort of defeats the notion of a dynamic link library. Licenses tied to a particular inode. Scripts that expect to run from tape, that's an old one. But the same sort of problems still apply. Systems that require a graphical installer, how many have those? Right. And you see, this is slides from 2000. We're 12 years later, and it's still happening. Packages that force interactive installation, how many people have got that one? 12 years later, we're still doing it. Systems that insist on being installed in one location, or in some cases, will install somewhere else, just won't work there. So I guess the message here is that plus ça change. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We've still got a lot of these problems to deal with, and DevOps doesn't solve them. DevOps solves a vertical set of problems quite nicely. And we have to understand what the things it does is, how we can leverage that mindset and those practices into what we do in the rest of the world, and try to, as I said, take this journey of DevOps into the enterprise. So DevOps is not new. Our job as system administrators is simple: to maintain the available integrity of computing resources and to support and encourage the effective use of those resources. That's a sage just definition from many, many years back. Our motivation, well, is to make ourselves redundant. It's something we'll never actually succeed at, and if we do, well, we move on to another job, bigger and better, but with our own great reference and et cetera. There's an old saying that people don't like doing work, lazy people invent ways to avoid work, and therefore progress is made by lazy people. That picture is someone running, having a picnic for Australia Day, running their rotisserie by plugging their power pack into a UPS they brought with them. Lazy people invent ways not to work. So how do we make ourselves redundant? I've got three strategies I've listed here. Consistency. More consistency means reduced effort across the fleet. You know what assumptions you can start making if there is a consistency. The moment you don't have consistency, all assumptions are off the table and have to be verified from base principles. That slows everything down. Strategy two, autonomous systems. Make the systems look after themselves as much as possible. Keep them the same and have them look after themselves. And, of course, strategy three is work on the right problem. Don't just, you know, sit there doing the same thing again and again and again. So back in the early 90s, my approach to this was I'm sick and tired of trying to remember how, you know, to change which file, which signal to send to which process to get it to reload. INetD's got one signal and you know, DNS has got another and all that sort of stuff. Why should I be remembering that stuff? That's not a good use of my time. It's like the people who think a good exam is you know, what command options you remember to LS. So I realized that, in fact, if I'm using version control, which I was on my files, then I can actually follow the same path for all of them. Check out the file, edit it, validate it. Of course, there are feedback loops I'm not showing on this for simplicity, but if it fails validation, you drop back into the editor, and if you quit from the editor, you've got an abort phase, which aborts the checkout, that sort of stuff. But validate it, check it back in, and then commit it. Now, the thing is that those yellow dots, they're identical for every for almost every file, or at least for, you know, 95% of them. So what I should be concentrating my effort on, well, commit, I only have to sort of find that and put it in one place. So all of my effort gets concentrating on the validate part. So what you end up with is a simple system that says, here are the defaults. Don't worry about them unless you want to override them. So, for example, to edit the password file, I can put an override in. But the important thing here is what I want to concentrate is on the green bits. So I would have a referring to a library routine that says validate the inetd.conf file, validate that I have edited it correctly, that I have left it safe, that I have left it correct. That means I'm now concentrating all of my effort on putting my knowledge as to what constitutes correct. And every time a problem slips through, I can improve that regression test suite and make it better. And we can share those. So that was early 90s, that was a system, so I just go change file name and everything's taken care of. The problem, of course, is that doesn't scale. That's for single machines. So then the next question is, how do we scale that up? How do we go from managing a single host to managing a fleet? So the trick, as I've implied many times, is you want to treat the fleet as a single system, not as a large number of independent hosts. You therefore need that consistency and that scalability practice. So again, going to my extremely gouty slides from many moons ago, this is a pack from 97, where the problem I had was we'd have one set of scripts to do the workload, the generation with Jumpstart, another set of scripts to push the initial configurations out to make them write, and a third set of scripts to maintain them as the system changes. And so you've got three places you've got to maintain everything, or as I used to call it, a maze of twisty passages all different. Bonus for the reference getters. So the better way, of course, would be to stick them all under one banner, one system that generated everything it needed, so that there was one point of maintenance. And now we've got a much more homogenous system straight away, less maintenance straight away. You're now in a maze of twisty patches all alike. This is part of what turned into what I had before everyone else, Ghost, before someone else stole the name, Jeff Halperin's operational support toolkit. It was a bunch of things with a host file in the middle that defined the attributes of the server, saying this is a Solaris box, this is a Solaris 5.6, it's in this location, it has these services that it provides, and it drove these other processes. CAB, the centralized administration baseline, HCB, the host configuration baseline. So the theory here is that CAB was the point where you did all of your maintenance of all of your configuration, and then you said, okay, go update the machines, and you would push configuration changes to the machines. So I'm of the school that I like push config management, not pull config management. Sorry, Mark. So you would have one point to maintain your configurations for all of your machines, and that would then push the right configurations out to the right servers based on the host definition, based on the duties we've assigned those machines. HCB was the counterpart. It would run scripts on the machine. It would capture the copies of certain files, the outputs of certain files, and stick them all into a baseline on the central machine. It would then run that same program every night and compare to the baseline and mail the administrator saying, by the way, these five files have changed overnight. Did you know that? And the communications goes up, the errors go down, you go, hold on a sec, who's been changing that file on me? Or, oh, someone else is working on that as a system as well, I've got to talk to them. So that was the system. As I said, it sort of looked a little bit more like this, and it was all about bringing consistency and scalability to our practices. Now, this was being used to manage 450 Sun machines. In this case, it was about 50 central servers, and the rest was engineering desktops. So we had about 450 Suns all being run out of a central config system, which is somewhat DevOps-y. CAB was a push system. Again, it, of course, because the tools at the time sat across RDIST over SSH, or SDIST as we called it, and that pushed the things out. As I said, it worked on this notion of a declarative language of what the machine would look like. In this case, a very, very simple syntax of, you know, this host is in this site, has this operating system, and it's a client, as opposed to it's a file server or something. And then that would translate into some rules that were placed on the top of the RDIST files, and the right thing would happen. So this is what we're now seeing with, you know, the new tools. The same sorts of declarative languages. We've been speaking about configuration management here for 20 years. We have these same discussions every year. This is not, you know, we can do practical solutions like this. We've been doing it for a long time. So I guess the thing is that when I referred to that slide about five or six slides ago that said that it's about treating the network as a single system, not as a large number of loosely coupled hosts, that's from a slide in 1995. These problems are the same. What we do, well, and I'm using this not as, gee, aren't I clever, I can name probably two dozen people who were at this conference this week who have done similar things. We as a group of professionals, have been doing these things for a long time. DevOps is not new. In 97, I was spinning up ISP in a box you would from the moment we finished doing the rack and stack, we could build and deploy a point of presence for an ISP inside of 30 minutes. It was using Solaris x86 because of the when it was. And again, as I said, so Linux came a little bit later. Jump started, including all of the reboots to apply all of the patches, configuration of Cisco routers, configuration of the central servers to talk to that new point of presence when it becomes installed, and all of that was in 97. Again, the sort of stuff that DevOps is doing today, we've been doing for a long time. So I thought I'd take a few minutes to talk about something a little bit deeper. Let's talk about a couple of these system administration practices and see how they do and don't work with DevOps. Change management. A perfectly stable system is easy. You unplug it. The practical reality, of course, is that it's subject to a continual string of changes from all directions. Patches, system faults, user problems, upgrades, new product entry, all of that stuff. So it's wrong to talk about a stable system. That's the wrong choice of terminology. What we are actually doing as system administrators is moving our systems from one stable state to another stable state. So the moment we talk about it as moving from one stable state to another stable state, it's a state diagram. We're talking about states, and we're talking about state transitions. That's interesting. Well, it turns out we're actually talking about two key processes, configuration management and change management. We treat our system as a state machine. Configuration management is therefore about managing the state definition and integrity, and change management is about managing the state transition integrity, which this says the same thing. So, for change management, what we're talking about then is it's actually got two jobs. It has to verify the correctness of this end state that we previously have not seen, and it has to verify the correctness of the work instructions to get us to that new state. Change management also is, of course, about risk management. So given those two duties of change management, we're really only talking about a certain small class of failures. Everything is fruit of the tree. So we're either talking about process failures or we're talking about in-state failures. We're either talking about process failures such as incorrect change procedure not followed correctly, or we followed the procedure, it was correct, and something weird happened. Or we're talking about in-state failures, which is that the change itself, the transition worked, but we didn't actually like where we ended up. All of our change management can be boiled down to those sorts of things. So this is looking at if we step back a couple of steps from the changes that we make every day. Of course, all of that boils down to a bunch of common risk mitigations. So, copying files sideways, splitting mirrors, snapshots, backups, all that sort of stuff. The things we do now. Automation helps us address people errors, so it helps us address the procedure not followed correctly. Copilots help us address the procedure not followed correctly or unexpected error during the procedure. So we have a number of different mitigation strategies, all of which address different parts of the potential failure. What about DevOps and change management? DevOps sees everything as a code push, is the bottom line. DevOps is highly optimized for one type of change, the code push. And that often requires a full build from scratch, but again, not always. They run production systems and they run them well. The service availability is paramount in what DevOps teams do. So within the vertical solution that they have crafted, they highly optimize change processes to ensure successful changes in the form of a code push. Configuration management's another one that, as I said, is critical to all of this. Traditional configuration management, there are a lot of tools. We've been talking about this for a long time. I was going to try to get a list of all of the LISA papers, but then I'd have twice as many slides. Many tools over the years have provided assistance to us. There have been many approaches, push-pull, centralized, distributed, etc., all the different abstraction models. There were good arguments earlier in this week about what constitutes the right types of abstraction. In the meeting in the session directly before this one, there were again those sorts of discussions about what is abstraction and does it help or does it hinder? And as I said, many papers. DevOps and configuration management, obviously they're also integrally tied. It's DevOps is completely reliant on automated configuration management for the vertical stack, for the application that is a DevOps application. And so DevOps this is a theme that DevOps is applied on a per application basis. And for configuration management, they often blow AVM and rebuild it, which of course we can't do. If we're talking about legacy infrastructure, we can't just sort of blow it away and rebuild it from scratch. I've been in the circumstance where I fixed the incorrect permissions on var temp and the application stopped working. So DevOps doesn't solve these problems, but it does establish a better culture for solving them. And this is one of these things, is DevOps is not something to be feared, it's something to be embraced, it's something to understand the limitations of it. It's, as I said earlier, the beginning of a journey, and we need to be on that journey with them. It needs to be our journey as well. So DevOps is a continuation of the path that we've been on since the beginning. In fact, it's the same path that we've been on. As I said, we've been doing this 15 years ago. Most importantly, DevOps is filling the void that our lack of progress as a profession has left unanswered. So we have to take responsibility for this new world. It's happening, it's being driven out of software engineering because we dropped the ball. We weren't in the room with them. I'm running ahead of time, but that's all good. Lots of time for question and feedback. Where are we going? Where's this path lead if we keep going down this path? What does it mean for us? Everything is software now. So we're moving towards software-defined data centers. Software-defined networking is, of course, the latest wave. We already have virtualized compute, virtualized store, virtualized networking in the form of VLANs. We're now moving towards a much more highly configurable network configurations. It's an interesting journey. Unfortunately, virtualization only gives us the first step. Virtualization of 20,000 hosts is still 20,000 individually managed hosts. We still have the same problems to solve. Automation. So I talk about cloud computing in several steps. The first is virtualization. The second is automation. So once you've got them there, you need to automate the way in which you manage that infrastructure, the way in which you provision more of that infrastructure. excuse me. Cloud standards are very much in their infancy. As I said before, we're in the land grab. Everyone's trying to get a piece of space now. Everyone is trying to build, use our cloud framework, do it our way. And we really don't have an idea what that is. At the moment, everyone's talking about IaaS and PaaS and a little bit of SaaS. Now, IaaS is infrastructure as a service. That's just give me a VM and I'll do the rest. I also have another layer. When we're talking about internal clouds, just above IaaS is ITaaS, IT as a service, which is where you provide not just the raw OSI, you provide the guest fully integrated into the environment, so including setting up DNS and AD and all of these other patching and AV, whatever you need is all done. And so what's delivered back is a machine that is not just a raw machine, but something that's actually usable and ready for software load. That's IT as a service. There are other services that we can be looking at that people aren't even really talking about, like SDLC as a service. If you're working in a large enterprise, you typically have 6 or so test environments on the way to production. You will have dev followed by something like SIT, which is system integration testing, perhaps component assembly testing, perhaps stress and volume testing, perhaps production verification testing, all of which the code moves through on its way to production. If you are running some of these environments, you often want to take a clone of production data, mask it for privacy reasons, and then start using that in the test environment to make sure you're actually working with real data. All of that is the software development lifecycle in the enterprise sense. So we should be looking to provide SDLC as a service, I log into the interface and I say, I want a clone of that test environment, thank you. And 5 minutes later, there it is. Or give me a snapshot of production data, thank you. Those are the sorts of things that we can be providing in an enterprise setting that are much more than IaaS and much more than platform as a service. So we have a journey that is going to take us in a bunch of different directions. We don't know exactly where. It's going to be a very interesting few years while we try a whole lot of ideas and see which ones stick. To help us on the way, this is my automation manifesto. What I'm interested in, I guess, as a show of hands, how many people are currently performing several of those things on the right, the ones in red? Use standards documents rather than templates or golden images. Use documented procedures and build instructions that you have to type the instructions in instead of just run a script. Use custom designs instead of standard offerings. Human written in Word or Excel artifacts for requesting things instead of machine parsable artifacts. How many people are guilty of these sins on the right? Yeah. That's the majority of the room. And that's the problem. That's in the enterprise sense, that's where we're coming from. Now, we need to fix our practices. This is stuff that's not directly to do with DevOps. This is stuff to do with doing our job better. If we had never heard of DevOps, this stuff still would be relevant. We need to automate. We need to automate for all of these things for all of those reasons. Where are we? So the interesting thing is that we've already jumped the chasm. WebOps was the beginning of this. The early adopters. DevOps is where we are now. It's being used, it's being talked about. Gartner is talking about DevOps. This is something that is here. This is not something that's just being worked in a few corners. As I said, DevOps is feeding off the fervor and the need that agile software delivery is generating. So this is well and truly here in the market now. I'm working with one of the larger companies in Australia, and we're looking at building internal infrastructure that is entirely cloud-based. All of these enterprises are looking at moving to clouds as quickly as they can. And that's not to say we can throw all the legacy out, much as we might like to, but there's now this notion that you've got strategic and you've got legacy. And strategic is cloud, is x86, VMs, everything here in... because otherwise you're paying for a metric truckload of power and space and all these other things. It's incredibly inefficient when you've got a bunch of E25Ks when you should have a rack of x86 boxes. So the enterprise private clouds, they're happening now. They're not happening in 5 years' time, they're happening right now. Cisco UCS, a bunch of other kit is all about trying to reduce the footprint, is all about trying to push this notion of internal cloud. Mainstream market, enterprise hybrid clouds. That's what we're going to see is the next big play, is that as these cloud standards start to settle down a little, and maybe a little bit before that, we're going to have a bunch of providers able to provide clouds to you. At the moment, that's done, again, via sort of a web interface or an API like Amazon saying, here's your stuff and here's your VPN trunked into your corporation. Infrastructure delivered via API will be the basis for large-scale enterprise outsourcing of infrastructure and associated support teams. Let me just let you sit and think about that. The previous wave of outsourcing, we got things really, really badly wrong. Rob Thompson likes to talk about process versus project work. Process work is that repeatable stuff you do over and over again. Project work is the one-off stuff. A project is actually defined as a one-off set of effort to get a specific set of outcomes. Each project is unique. The problem was that we treated the project work of system administration as process work, and we tried to outsource it. And by we, I mean management. What happened was mostly a huge failure. Because you can't outsource project work successfully. You have to outsource process work. So what we really did in the first wave was just outsource people. But it's different this time. If I've got a bunch of nominally standard offerings from nominally standard cloud providers, that's a different type of outsourcing. And that's one of the reasons I think a lot of these enterprises are scrambling to build up their internal clouds, and they can, great, not my problem anymore. So I think we're looking at the beginning of the next wave of outsourcing. The way you do this in a more, in a better way is, excuse my inability to actually draw decent diagrams, you have a series of service domains. You might have multiple compute providers, multiple storage providers, multiple network providers. Above the top of that is a service bus where you advertise, here is what I have to offer. Here are the SLAs, here is the gold service, here is the silver service. This is what you can buy. You advertise those things. The consumer says, great, I'm going to take one of these and five of those and ten of those. Thank you very much. This allows you to actually outsource in a more intelligent way. You can do outsourcing, actually doing SLA-based comparisons and cost comparisons of providers, because the providers are all providing the same thing now. They're all providing cloud-based standardized infrastructure, be that storage or compute or whatever else. So we're hitting an interesting time in the next few years as this stuff starts to settle out. To do an enterprise service bus, this is very much a full service provider model. I'm seeing this right now in large enterprises, building service bus-based clouds. Now, this is different. The current generation of cloud frameworks are all first generation. They're all wrong. They're all exactly what you expect from a first generation. They all have a very fixed model of what a cloud looks like. The next generation of cloud frameworks is going to be much more generic, much more interesting, and we're just seeing the beginning of that happen now. So the idea here is that, again, it's all driven by APIs, and those APIs now are evolving into message bus APIs, which is, I think, a little bit ironic that the irony here is that infrastructure is treated more like code, then the very frameworks and patterns we use in enterprise code become relevant to enterprise infrastructure. So to finish, the cost models of IT enterprise are broken, and management is under incredible pressure to reduce costs. And if you're not moving to a cloud model for your IT service delivery, you are setting yourselves up to be outsourced. If you're not building your internal clouds, if you're not thinking about automation, if you're not getting ahead of this game, it's going to hurt. We are now in the decade of the API where everything is code. But we're at the beginning of this transition. There's plenty for everyone to do. So this is a land of opportunity, not a land of fear. What you do next is up to you. Questions? Please go to... Please name and affiliation.
Jay, and no thanks. Okay. very good talk. I appreciate it. But I'm wondering, a lot of what I've seen, you covered kind of a lot of how DevOps changes our way of doing things. But sort of something that I have trouble with sometimes is how DevOps change how devs do things. Primarily meaning that, you know, maybe they get a lot more reach into the system than they might have in a more traditional model. And, you know, how do you sort of work in that where you keep your system safe from maybe a developer who shouldn't be working on systems code and should be working on developer code? Kind of like I wouldn't commit a major code commit to their repo. You know, how do I sort of enforce that on the other side as well?
I think you need to be careful of a false dichotomy, because it's not them and us. So you've got to stop talking about it in terms of them and us. There is a code repository, some of which looks after the system, some of which looks after, you know, the more traditional code base, but dev is responsible for the repository, and you as a member of the dev team are part of that. So the question is not how do you stop them getting at those parts of the repository. The question is how do you ensure the integrity of changes to that part of the repository, irrespective of who makes them.
Well, I didn't necessarily mean it in us versus them. I mean it more in a skill set method. Like, I don't care what someone's title is. If they're qualified to do something, I want them to do it. But just like I'm not qualified to write high-scale software development, you know, code for development purposes, you know, maybe there are developers on teams who aren't qualified to write high-scale systems configs.
So I guess that's going back to, you know, one of the first things is this notion of culture and getting in the room. You know, the reason we put ops in the room with dev is to help teach them that stuff, is to mentor them on that stuff, is to actually contribute to those discussions and those designs to make sure that the result is what it should be. And that includes, there's a major push within DevOps is to make sure we've got the right metrics in place, because you don't just guess at whether something's going to work, you measure it. You measure it before and you measure it after and you work out what the impact was and whether against what it was supposed to be. So part of this, from my perspective, it's make sure you put you instrument the code according in the system accordingly so you can see what's going on. And part of it is spend your effort working on how to validate changes and validate, you know, that test-driven development notion. And one of the big challenges for us is how do we adapt test-driven development to testing system services? You know, so do we have a regression test suite for DNS? Do we have a regression test suite for DHCP? How do we test these services before and after changes? I think that's one of our challenges, again, as a group. These are the things that we really should only need to develop once and then publish across the industry and use across the industry. So there are a lot of challenges, and I don't know if I've necessarily answered your question, though.
Not really, but I asked a bad... I don't think I asked the right question anyway. It's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. I think you're bang on almost every one of those slides. Just hanging off of your last couple of slides or so, I've got kind of a question for everyone in the room. Is anyone here currently involved in any way with a company that is completely cloud-based? No local infrastructure other than desktops? We already have...
There's one or two hands.
You, yeah. Yeah, this is a trend that I've started seeing among friends who have startups in the South San Francisco Bay Area. You know, because I'm an infrastructure wonk, I ask them, so, you know, who's doing your server room? And they say, what server room? Mm-hmm. It's all running at Amazon.
Yeah.
This, you know, you've got a couple of good chilling slides in your deck there. That fact of the completely cloud-based startup, that should be equally chilling to everyone here.
You're absolutely right. More and more companies are, in fact, looking at this. Again, you don't do this overnight. You dip your toe in the water and try a little bit. The USENIX office is busy moving towards cloud services where that makes sense to do. So, you know, where we've got things like Salesforce, where we've got things like conference registration systems that are software as a service. So there's a bunch of software as a service providers that can give you a lot of these solutions. Google Docs, you know, simple solutions. There are a lot of smaller companies that can survive without any computer infrastructure in the physical sense.
Yeah.
Apart from, you know, their MacBook they sit in the cafe with.
Yeah, thank you.
Looking to the future when perhaps most of us will be living and working in this kind of environment, there will still be the companies like Salesforce and Amazon who do still need to have large physical facilities for their own services. Hopefully they'll be using these same principles.
Very much.
Do you see at a point that we will be bringing people from outside of computing into our culture? For instance, putting an API on the building, on a data center, on physical facilities, and using the same principles and bringing them back into our culture?
Oh, absolutely. I've said this is the decade of the API, and that's a universal statement. That's not just about infrastructure. We're seeing that more and more, and as I said, there are companies that specifically specialize in helping you first in terms of the core infrastructure to be that gateway, but also in terms of the services to assist companies in exposing any number of their systems via APIs to either a developer community, internally, externally, all of those options. I think that APIs around buildings, etc., and again, part of an API is the security, so I won't get into those details, but you will absolutely see APIs on anything people can get it on and a whole bunch of things they really shouldn't have put it on.
Great. Thank you.
Sorry, it's bounce of being up front. Matthew Barr, Snap Interactive.
I'm wondering, we're an agile shop for development. We're sitting with the devs. But there are a lot of elements of working in an agile fashion that doesn't necessarily work as well for sysadmins. I am curious if you've got any resources for workflows for sysadmins. I mean, we're using Trello to go ahead and do the Kanban type wall. It works somewhat, and it works relatively well for some projects, but it doesn't work nearly as well as standard ticketing systems for capturing state and repeatability for some things, we found. There's also just a lot of other issues in terms of trying to find a workflow for Agile, and I'm curious if you have any resources for Agile sysadmin work as opposed to Agile development.
So I don't have references per se, but I've spoken about this a couple of times in the tutorial sessions earlier in the week. One of the things that I have done in traditional environments is I talk about I guess there are four or five categories of workflow. There are system faults and user problems. They'd be the red cards. There are, and again, physical or virtual. There'd be normal system upgrade requests like patching, all that sort of stuff, so they'd be green cards. There'd be cards for new code pushes and things like that, so maybe yellow. And you have whatever's left, blue, for infrastructure improvement works. So if they're the five categories you're interested in, they're the ones I sort of tend to think about. What you can do is, your reds come directly from the users and they're worked through the ticket system, be that a Kanban-based system or another one with a Kanban front end. So, for example, Atlassian have Jira, which is a normal ticketing system, but with GreenHopper over the top of it to give it the Kanban.
Which one's on top?
GreenHopper. You get it from the same. It's all from Atlassian. But that's about having the Kanban facade across a ticketing system. So you have all of the value of the ticketing system. You don't lose any of that, but you also get all the advantage of the Kanban walls for presentation.
We've been using Trello. I hadn't realized that Atlassian had something similar.
Yeah. Again, there are lots of them out there. I'm not endorsing blah blah blah. But there are a lot of options there. So that's at that layer. But the thing is that so you've got the red cards going straight into the system. For the yellow, green, for the proactive work, the yellow, green, blue cards, they either come into the system. What I do is I sit down with the entire team. We spend an afternoon with pizza, beer, whatever, and a projector and Omni Outliner or something, and we put together a structured work plan for the group. All of the pain points, what are the projects that we're going to do to make our life better, to make our customers' life better, et cetera, et cetera. We pull them down. We can then take that work, convert that into a monthly iteration. So in this case, the iteration might be a month for operations. And given there's so much reactive work that we have to deal with, we're not never quite sure how much we'll get done. Yeah. So you put together a monthly program of work. You feed that into the hopper as the blue tickets and yellow tickets and everything else. At the end of the month, you get back together for a retrospective, just like other Agile projects, and say, what did we get done? What do we think we're going to get done? What do we have to do next month? Let's plan the next iteration. Yeah. So I think you can still take many of these Agile techniques and apply them to operations successfully.
The biggest issue we've had has really been in time boxing, because there are so many injections in a normal day that you can maybe put in a half a day at most of planned stuff, and everything else just goes to hell.
Yeah, and that's very much the point, that we have a huge reactive element, and in fact, the only way to address the reactive element is by the blue cards, is by the improvement programs. And so it's why I think it's really important that you have this monthly get-together, you put together a monthly program of work, and you go back and check it how you did. And the only way you'll start pulling those red numbers down is by being able, it's a virtuous cycle. The more you spend on blue, the more time you have to spend on blue, because the less you're doing on red.
Yeah.
Okay. I think one more question, and then we will bring Carolyn up.
Hi, Garrett Wallman, MIT. So my organization doesn't produce code. We produce PhDs and journal articles. So how exactly is this stuff going to be relevant to the sort of thing that I have to do on a daily basis running a network for 800 graduate students?
Okay. So at one level, it's not as relevant. There are always going to be environments where it's not as relevant. And so if you've got, how do you adapt this sort of stuff to HPC? How do you attach this sort of stuff to research and university environments? Not everything looks like enterprise. Not everything looks the same. You're absolutely right that some of it won't be as applicable. But if you come in with an open mind and you look at the practices that you're getting from DevOps, and the practices, as I said, around a monthly iteration and Kanban for visibility, because you still have a bunch of tickets that you have to work. You still have a bunch of problems, upgrades, key deadlines where the system has to be looked after. All of those things still apply in that environment. If the system's maintenance is happening in the middle of people trying to finish up their PhDs, they're not going to be particularly happy. If it stops people submitting their LISA papers on time, other people won't be very happy. So, it's roundabouts, swings and roundabouts. All right, so at this point, I would like to say thank you very much and bring Carolyn back up.